Hello, everybody. Welcome to the new bonus episodes, or the bonus series, for the second season. I attended the Costa Rican Big Data School, and, you know, I thought that maybe some of you can take some value out of this. You know, many aspiring computer scientists and software engineers would really benefit from the things that they talk about in this event. This was a five-day event from Monday through Friday, from 8 to 4, so it was pretty extensive, and they talked about a lot of different subjects and, you know, very important things that you got to know in this day and age with big data and data science and data analysis. So I thought, you know what? I'll put this up. Maybe some of my listeners can take advantage of this and can benefit from listening to really, really high-end professors from the Texas Advanced Computing Center. So our instructors will be Wei-Ya Xu. He's a PhD and the group lead for Data Mining and Statistics Group. Prior to joining TAC, he obtained a master's degree in biological sciences and a doctoral degree in computer science from the University of Texas at Austin. Then there's also Charlie Day. Charlie Day is the Director of Training and Professional Development with the User Services Group at TAC, with a background in web development and scientific computing. Charlie's responsibilities at TAC include organizing, developing content, and building curriculums for TAC's academic course selection taught in conjunction with several departments at the University of Texas at Austin, as well as for TAC's professional development and educational team. Oh, well. Oh, and just a quick thanks to Danny Xie, who was the one who recorded these segments. Without him, we wouldn't have this awesome bonus round. So thank you very much, and enjoy.
And how Spark can be used or good for large-scale data analysis. So before I begin, I want to do a quick review on what we had to talk about yesterday. The MapReduce and the Hadoop clusters, right? So when we talk about the MapReduce, what are the things you still remember or recall from yesterday? Anyone? Or you completely forgot them? Yeah, it's on the slides. Well, so it's a blueprint for big data problems. The more MapReduce problem model introduced is more innovation on unified data representations. So the data representation is a very big important factor for big data analysis, because you need finding an efficient and good way to model your data so you can manage them and you can analyze them. So that's what's the most advanced features of MapReduce at the time. It does modular data processing, and it's just trying to separate parallelism from computations by moving computation to the data. So those actually is now that innovative, but MapReduce models provide a very nice framework for putting them together to unify them. So if you recall the things I didn't put there are the two key things about MapReduce problem models, right? So one is it has two important interfaces. You know, without two important functions, the map and reduce, right? So the map is basically do the work distribution where you want to disseminate a large scale data processing into multiple smaller works that being mapped out into different nodes for them to process. And then the reduce is to collecting the result from those individual workers and then assemble your final result you need. So through this way, the MapReduce can be scalable and elastic to the infrastructure we have, right? And the other thing we mentioned is about the unified data representations. And specifically, what MapReduce does is to define the data in a form of key value pair. Anyone still remember that? So once you can define that, you can model different type of data, different format of data in the same way. So you will have the same logic or same algorithm can be applied to them for your big data analysis. So both of those are kind of very important. As we introduce Spark, you will see those ideas is not gone, it's now completely different. The Spark is a kind of evolution on top of the MapReduce programming models, just makes things a little bit quicker and better. So the other part we introduced yesterday is Hadoop clusters. So my previous was like from pure computer science point of view, it's a programming model, so itself doesn't really map into anything. So Hadoop is an open source implementation of these programming models. Then the Hadoop soon evolved from just a library to support this type of programming into a full-fledged cluster systems. So it has a lower level storage system, which we call the HDFS, and that is the most important and very useful component that's still used today in almost every big data processing system there. So now the Hadoop, when people talk about Hadoop, it's less mean it's might reduce programming functionality, although that part is still unused today, but more referring to the Hadoop as a cluster, as an infrastructure, as a data processing platform there. Any questions from yesterday's or from MapReduce and the Hadoop clusters? Is anyone have a chance to try the runners? Have you tried lockdown? Well, we're going to try today, I guess. So now as I showed this picture yesterday, but we sort of in a big way. The things when I showed it yesterday, it sort of to emphasize what's good about Hadoop carbon models. So we purposely trying to emphasize the two parts, my part and the good part. So that's a part when you want to make a program, developing a program to do a data analysis, that's a part you need to worry about and to implement. But in between, there's so many different pieces in the Hadoop cluster systems. On one hand, they are good because they make things simpler for you as a developer, so you don't need to worry about them, how things can be done in a particular clusters. But on the other hand, they soon became a sort of bottleneck to a lot of data processing works, right? So for example, when we talk about the map and reduce, we always say they take input and key value pair as an input, and they output a key value pair of output a key value pairs. But we never mention where the output to, right? So we just say it's return something, but who really get it and who really receive it? Right, so anyone have any questions or have any thoughts? So supposedly you have this master framework and then you have one master thread and managing and coordinating all those map processes. So the map process eventually need to return something back to this master of your master application, your application master, and for A to process to the next step. So for example, from map to combine, there needs some intermediate agent to collecting them and processing them to the next steps. So in the map, in the Hadoop clusters, all those intermediate things was monitored by a single thread, and also the way they're doing it is by first output the file, output the results into a disk system as a file. Then the next step will read from that file and do that processing. So they do it for a couple of reasons. So by the time when the Hadoop first being proposed, it's about 10 years before, 10 years ago. So at that time, the hard drive is much smaller, has a much smaller capacities, and more easy to get errors. So when memory is more expensive than today's, so they want to leverage the hard drives in a cheap ways, and then they can have a redundancy so the data doesn't get lost. So in a traditional, like early implementation of the MapReduce or Hadoop clusters, all those intermediate key value output, they start with the key value pairs on the disk inside the HDFS, and for each mappers, and their result will be written into an intermediate space on your HDFS as an intermediate result. Then the next steps they combine will read from that location, that specific locations, and to do the processing. And then output and write back the result into the disk again. So each of those intermediate steps are done with the I/O processes, right? So what's the problem with that? It's good or it's bad? It's a yes, exactly. So if whenever you write things into the disk, it will take time. Then it takes time again to read them back. So even the MapReduce trying to do that in a distributed way, but there are still a lot of time wasted in there. And if we can directly pass the data from micro result to the combined result or to the future one, that will definitely speed up the processing as well. So data version, there's a lot of optimization built in. And in between the Hadoop and Spark, there are also a lot of other big data processing framework, and they do different level of the optimizations in those details as well. And then the other biggest part is one of the nice things of the MapReduce is that we don't need to worry about like explicitly how the data being distributed and how we collecting them. From Mapper to the Reduce, there's an important step called shuffle and sort, where this step will aggregate from all the mappers that share the same keys by putting them together and organizing them into a reduce process and for them to continue processing. So the shuffle and the sort is a key step within the MapReduce framework, but also this is very easy to begin. Very commonly, the most where the bottleneck happens is in that process. Your processing workflow may end up spending most of time in that shuffle and sort process just to get ready from MapReduce, get them ready to the reduce input there, right? So the MapReduce are good in terms of the programming concept and for implementation. It is for such systems, but soon, like 3 or 4 years later, after it's being proposed, there is a number of systems trying to do the optimizations on top of this and trying to make them better. So that's what we want to focus on today and talk about more is the Spark, right? So Spark now is in a more dominant form for people who are doing the big data analysis now. So it was designed to overcome those shortcomings we just mentioned with Hadoop and MapReduce process. So one thing we mentioned is a Hadoop relay on a lot of disk-based operations. All the intermediary output are written in the disk and read back to them. And a lot of them are not necessary. So if we can have a nice in-memory distributed memory structures, and we can keep hosting them in memory rather than writing into the disk. And also the shuffle sort is easily became one of the most common bottlenecks for the any MapReduce kind of the processings. And also there are some other native limitation with the MapReduce that ties more to how the resource being allocated. We briefly mentioned that yesterday, but didn't get a chance to get into more details. But in summary, what happens is because the yarn will allocating resources per containers, so you have some tasks that may use more memory, but will waste eventually waste the CPU processing powers on your disk. Or some of the tasks might be limited by the computation or memory capacities on the on each node. So each node will end up with a nice potential parallelism it can achieve. So a lot of time, the MapReduce frameworks, their parallelism is we talk about three things of the parallelism. One is the parallelism is limited by how many data you have in the split. So that's determining how many nodes can run them, because you can only run computation on the data it is, right? Secondly, is you are also bound by the physical resources, the computational resources you have. So that's decide how many computational containers it can be assigned, how many live tasks can be initiated. So those together and make it Hadoop and MapReduce a nice efficient in terms of the parallelism. It doesn't be able to fully utilize the power of the buildings in such a way. And then the last common shortcomings is the Hadoop was first proposed, the MapReduce was first proposed by Google to use for like say nightly processing of all the graphics we have cloud and to converting them from text documents into built-up index. So the whole concept is built up on top of this batch processing concept. So you're deriving something, you run them iteratively or repeatedly on them. But a lot of big data analysis may require more interactive or more streaming type of analysis. Both of those are very hard to be compatible with MapReduce and Hadoop clusters. So the Hadoop has still used a lot today, but more for the batch processing. So I know, like say, for example, Facebook uses them to generating social networks overnight based on people's postings. but they won't use that to do, say, real-time monitoring or any other type of processing there. So any questions about those limitations of Pi-Do? So how you will solve it if you are the engineering today, you want to improve it? What's your ideas? Anyone? No idea? So, well, fortunately, someone has ideas, so we have a better system now. So the Spark is a cluster computing platform that designed to be more efficient and more general purpose. It achieved it by in different aspects. So in the speed-wise, it's trying to run more computation in memory, and it's trying to do less work that require disk. So it's basically will radio data trying to capture it as much as possible in a distributed memory pool rather than assuming them always on the disk. And then they have a set of execution workflow kind of optimizing, so to minimize the needs to write those data back into the disk for the intermediate processes. And the other ways to increase the generality is trying to support not just the batch processing, but it's more interacting on the streaming type of processes. So the streaming based processing is more on demand today. That's a lot of cases where we want to do real-time monitoring, say this video feed or this posting or on the Twitter, so we want to be able to immediately stop any bad posting or any fake news on theirs. So that became a very important thing, so that's one thing the Spark can support you quite well. The Spark has a better accessibility, it has more, so the Hadoop has a certain way to interface with other programming language, so particularly through the streaming API it's providing. But streaming API has its own limitations further put penalty to the performance. So it's not very, so even you could say doing a batch to the word count or doing a Python for the word count, but the efficient is much less desirable than using a native Java implementations. But the Spark dealing with is approaching the problem with a different way. So it's building a lot of the APIs that can directly interact with the object created in another programming language and directly interacting with them. So it has a better accessibility and usability for people familiar with a different type of the programming language as well. Okay. So putting them together to make the Spark programming model is more usable and than the MapReduce models in general. So that is probably most of the Spark, generic big data processing works using now is a Spark some type of Spark based processing. So all those things are the good thing about Spark, right? So how exactly Spark can achieve those from the seemingly very good, very revolutionary MapReduce model to here? That is due to a core concept in the Spark called the RDD. So how many of you have heard about RDD before? Okay, so let's start with the beginning, what RDD stands for. So the RDD stands for a resilient distributed disk size, right? So that's RDD, right? So it is the most fundamental, like kind of the data structure, data abstraction inside the Spark. So it's like the key value pair we mentioned in the MapReduce, it's a basic data abstract also for the MapReduce, for the Hadoop. And the RDD is a basic abstraction for the Spark type of processing. On top of the just like what exactly we mean by resilient distributed disk type is share two properties. One is marked highlighting the right here. One is called immutable and one is called partition collections. So first, how many of you familiar with this term immutable? Okay, so what immutable means?
It doesn't change.
Yeah, it it's not, it doesn't change, it cannot be changed in the quantum world. So once you define some variable as immutable, it cannot be changed, right? So under the other characters is a partition, so which means it's a base set, whether it's being partitioned, it can be partitioned into subset automatically and being stored in the places. So those two properties are important to make it, the RDD, this particular structure, resilient to fault and be able to easily distribute it out in a distributed environment. Okay? So the RDD contains a set of partitions, and the RDD is immutable, and the value cannot be changed. So for the first one, the partition, it seems easier to understand because we want something that can be distributed, so eventually we need to cut them into different chunks or different partitions, so each part size can work on one. So that's a similar idea with when you input your data into the Hadoop cluster, it's being split and stored in the different nodes or different sections of your clusters. So that part is easy to understand why we need them, but the other part seems a little bit harder to understand is why RDD has to be immutable, which means once I define my data as RDD, the program, the platform, doesn't want you to change them. Any reason you can see how? Okay, let's hold on to that questions and try to understand it better through the rest of the lectures, okay? So I can tell you the answers now, but you may not fully understand why it's needed here. But why we want it to be mutable is since RDD is supposed to be shared across multiple nodes, so which means like I have a vector with 100 elements, but I don't want one process working on these 100 elements. I want to say 10 process working on 10 elements at the same time, right? So if my data structure can be easily changed, so I start with 1 to 100, and then I distribute them out, and some processing working on 20 to 30, while some processing 10 to 20. If the data structure can easily change, say one process decides to, I want to make change it into something between 110 to 120, then when we collect them back, the result may not be consistent anymore. So in part, it is, so to make them consistent, the alternative way would be we need some type of synchronization. So the one thread will tell all others, now I'm updating them from this value to that. So that essentially is another type of the operation could be particularly expensive and waiting for other thread will only to owe everyone else sending an update. So if you don't want to do that, then if you make the base structure changeable, you have the risk of the data being inconsistent during the processing. So that's one of the fundamental reasons why the RDD needs to be mutable, because it needs to be shared across multiple processes. So we just don't want, it's basically the developer says, I don't trust the future users state rules, do not change them easily. So I just make a rule to say, you just cannot change it. Right? Just for the sake of the safety of your program that can easily run into different bugs or craft your data. And also, if once we make them immutable, you can treat them as a sort of a contained pieces, and you can easily move them along between resources within a cache, and to simplify the development. So when you're developing them, you don't need to consider like synchronization problems at all. Right. Okay. So that's kind of one of the fundamental reasons why we want to make the design decisions RDD immutable. But once we make it immutable, what RDD is actually does is so when we first introduce it, like on the previous slide, when we first say it is a distributed partition the data set, So the things what you can relate to is maybe more like a list, right? So a list of the values layers. So in fact, RDD can be seen of that way as a distributed list. But since RDD is immutable, what the RDD actually does is captures a list of the dependency of how these list values are being generated. So in the program, so even in the representation, it's representing the data in the form of the list. But the actual store, actual storage of the RDD, actual management of the RDD is actually more than just the value of your data, but also including how your data coming from or where your data coming from. So your data may say, this RDD, I'm creating them from the list. Then the RDD even will know it is created from that list. Or if this RDD is created from the file, then it will know it's created from file. Or it is from some action or some processing from other RDD. The later RDD will actually keep that processing history, processing workflow somewhere. So what that makes RDD became a can be recreated at any time. Okay. So anyone have questions or complete lost so far? Yes.
the basic point I the idea of the recreated content. So I don't know if you can please explain a little more about it.
In next several slides, I will have an illustration about that. Okay. As well. What's your question, please? Yes.
Okay. You just had a question about cryptocurrency. Do you know if there are some relationships between cryptocurrency and all the process? Because in cryptocurrency, usually it's immutable and can
Okay, thank you, sorry. So do you know if there is some relationship between all the process that involve cryptocurrency and the use of Spark in this kind of environments? Because usually cryptocurrency or the blockchain is immutable and you can use or keep all the information spread in many places. So do you know if there is some relationship or the use of Spark in this kind of environments?
Cryptocurrency?
Yeah, like Bitcoin, Ethereum, yes. This technology is applied in this kind of environment.
No, I think the immutability applies to the cryptocurrency, but the Spark has no direct relations with the Bitcoin to the blockchain technology. So those are different set of technologies. They both share some properties like immutables, but they are not the same. Is that what your question is?
Well, my question is if the Spark is used in this kind of technology or like, and can you be used in all the environment with the policy?
I think it's possible, but I haven't really had any personal experience with it, or I've seen any people trying to put them together. I read a proposal where they're trying to put data and feed and the blockchain together, but it doesn't really make sense. So one thing is the two things we usually use here, the Hadoop and the Spark, they are actually all centralized processes. So which means even they are distributed, they're always the master's right, trying to oversee all the processes right there. Right. So that is in conflict with a fundamental concept in the blockchain where they want a completely decentralized process. So I'm not sure which part of apply your mean there, but those two sides of technology has some fundamental difference here. Okay. Does that make sense to you? Or?
Yeah,
if I misunderstood your question, you can ask me later.
Yeah, I have the same question. If there are some relationships between those technologies, so that's fine.
Can you explain better why the RDD has to be seen as a deterministic function rather than a data
object? Okay. So let me address to the next several slides. Do some illustration, but trying to see if we can understand that part better, right? So let's start with a simple thing. So yesterday, Charlie gave a Python introduction, right? So in Python, can we introduce this, right? So say in a single machine, and you have a list, So that means that it will be stored in the memory within a single machine, so no. So now we want to do a distributed list structure, and then we want to turn that list into the RDD so we can distribute it out. So conceptually, you can think about, instead of having one list, and we can break them into, say, four lists, and then four sub-lists, and then each one of them belongs to one node. So we can say, from the master thread, breaking this list into four partitions, and send them out, while the master thread will still see them as one list. So that's exactly the idea of a partition of this size that we can distribute them out. So in this case, we have four partitions, and each one of them pipe into a different one. So here, I want to emphasize that even we say RDD is a resilient distributed data set, the RDD itself is could just have one partition, or have four partitions, but all four partitions are in the same node. So it's up to the master process and the resource to determine that, right? So remember here, here this picture makes perfect sense. You have four, you want to distribute out four. But the actual implementation, this is just like virtual models of implementations of the data. The four partition can be on the same data side, or can be on the same node, or only on three node, it doesn't really matter. Okay. So from here, and we generating the partitions, and then a lot of the computations of the RDD processing, we will say can be active per partition. So that's how we can do the parallel processing, difficult processing. So this part is something very similar to the MapReduce programming as well. So where you have the data stored in the different data node in the Hadoop clusters, then each hypers will only work on the data stored in that process. Right, so now when we say we want to do a sum, we want to get the sum of this list with the total sum of these values. Right, so if for a single thread, for a single node, we would traverse through this list and just add them together to get an answer. So for the list of A, that's not the problems. In the distributed computations, in the MapReduce or Sparkways, and what we will do is we will pass that sum functions to each individual partition where the data type, where this resides, and then just asking to do that function on that particular partitions. So in this case, it's sort of like mapping, but what we do map is map the sum functions into each of the partitions. Okay. Now we're getting the result from each partition of the sum. Then what you're getting here, so in the MapReduce way, is you have input here, you have output here, and those output will automatically go through a reduced process and try to piece out the future data there. But in the RDD processing, the data doesn't move yet. It will stay there and it becomes a new RDD, right? So from these processing, you're starting with one RDD, and you end up generating another RDD. That cause of sum became this dependency. So basically saying this new RDD was generated from this RDD through this function. So that's what we mean. The previous slide is capture the history of how this data being generated. Right? Why is that? In two slides I will show you why you want to do that. But that's what we mean by the dependency. So the new RDD we have here depends on the input RDD and depends on the function we are applied to it. Okay. So this is RDD, the output is RDD and the window. So now we want to take that the dependency is we know that computers is actually not that reliable. There is always random mistake with your memory, so sometimes if your computer heats up and then your computer freeze, it's because there are some memory errors somewhere, so the system can restart. So everybody might have a problem before, right? So it's the same thing with all the computers, right? And especially for the big data, it became a big problem, right? You may see your computer freeze up, let's say if you work 8 hours, it may freeze up once, or 8 hours, freeze up once. But if we're talking about 1,000 computers, processing them 24/7, the chances one computer goes by, some memory error happens, it's actually becoming more routines than you may be expecting. So one of the terms I have been mentioning in both yesterday and today's lecture is called fault tolerance. So that is also another very important consideration in the big data systems. Just because of the fact we need using a lot of distributions, we need to do a lot of processes. So if your system is very vulnerable, one process goes bad, like this case, then the whole sum you need to redo it or you need to restart your program, that will be a lot of time wasted. So the fault tolerance is speaks to the ability to recover from the errors like this, right? So for example, in this case, if like we have four nodes doing that, but for some reason, one node just decided I don't want to do the sum correctly and going back to it, then you're going to have a long time coming back. At some point, and your program will return errors to say, if we do not do anything trying to recover or trying to tolerate this kind of errors, then your whole program will be problem. So you may already spend 8 hours before that, then you need to do that 8 hours, right? So that's why the paper dependency is important. Is once we keep the dependency, we know this RDP coming from here, and if after this we got an error, so we may, the framework will see there may be something wrong with this RDP, or through some integrity check, then because we have the dependency, the framework can automatically to restart from the previous RDP to calculate the new RDP to make the problem run again. So if you got a chance to really try the library use, either Hadoop or Stable Spark, and sometimes if you do a lot of processing, you will see in the log, sometimes say a type 1, a type 2, a type 3. So by default, the system will try a error like 3 times and then with some timeout limitations and try to see if you can do that recovery. MapReduce has its own way. The fact that MapReduce trying to put everything on disk is a way to do the fault tolerance with more duplications. In a Spark, because we want to do things in the memory, so there's more chance to get the encryptions and the errors out. So the resilience, the immutabilities became very important. And then the keep the dependency of how this RDP became important so it can recover itself. Does that make sense now? Okay. So RDE is for developers, for us, you can view them as a distributed data. But the actual implementation is more like a function, a history of functional processes. It's always tell where I came from, like where this data came from. So you can trace them back to the initial RDE or to the initial files on the disk or your resources. Okay. Any other questions about RDDs? Okay. So the RDD is the most fundamental concept, is that p-value pairs is the way how Spark do the data abstractions and how many of the functions that can work well with the Spark. Okay. So now yesterday I showed this pictures. So I'm mentioning, so now in the big data views, we view Hadoop more like operating system levels where they help you to store and managing those data. Then we have the Spark and Scala is more like a problem, so people can build developing all kinds of processing network on top of it. So I got an interesting question yesterday, I forgot from who. Why Python and R is the outside the box, while the Scala is the inside the box. So the more I think about it is really when I say the Scala is a native programming language, it's not by chance you just want to choose this fancy, let's use the programming language for that purpose. But there's a lot of the alignment between how the Scala as a programming language can define versus what the version of Spark has. So the two are really, you want to have a little bit of understanding of both, be able to understand better the conceptuals that being used in the Spark and helps you to develop the program in the future. So in the next slide, next 40 minutes, so what I would like to do is I will give a quick tour to highlight some of the features the Scala programming language has that you do not see them in other programming language theory, like Python's. So, but on the other hand, there's a lot of similarities between the Scala, Python, and Java nowadays.
But unfortunately, the Jupyter is a very good and powerful application tools, but it doesn't support Scala as a kernels. So for the next, what I want to try is to try another applications. So I showed you before. It's actually this one I showed here, called Zapping. So it's a web application. It's a lot like Jupyter's. It's a type of notebook applications that you can use it directly as an interpolator analysis. It supports a lot of the different language patterns in different kernels. One of the features I like it is one is there's several features I like it. I want to introduce them. It's one is it has a better integration with the Spark because Zapping itself is implementing Scala and it's automatically comes with Scala interpreters and it automatically can give you a pseudo Spark cluster so you download install them on your own laptop and try to use them. Secondly, it has an interface with many different programming language. Not only like in the Jupyter, and you can select different kernels, you can select different programming language within the same notebook. So you can have one paragraph using Scala and the other paragraph using Python, the other paragraph using R, and you can intermix based on what you need and to achieve a more flexible way. It even supports JavaScript, so you can build a little widget or GUI interface in some paragraphs and control other paragraphs. So we use it for several. We use it for training for the big data, and we also use it for some of the research projects. And at the end, we want to build up equipped applications for the users, and we can choose this and using the language. We will build up visualization, build up analysis, build up the controls. So it's a very good tools. We have the Rumbler, we have a Zapping installed on Rumblers. So today, I even regardless whether you have tried or not, you have to try it now. So let's open up your terminal windows. You're supposed to install yesterday. So if you're using Mac, you can just directly open your terminals. And if you install the other mobile terms, and you can open that one. So either way, you should find in some command line interface and where you can input command line into it. So what you're going to do is do SSH, then followed by the username. Username is a white paper you get from yesterday's. So let's start with the training something, 259 to 270 something. Then add the rumbler.test.test.eu. Okay? So please just really try to do that. Putty is quite cool. So these kind of tools can help you to do the SSH connection, that's fine, but we need a command line interface for that. So if you have any questions, let us know. So we are trying to see what's the problem it is. So if you succeed, once you log on to the router, here's something what you should see on your screen. It's login1.router instead of your home laptop. So if you are able to log on to the routers, just raise your hand and let me know how. So if you have trouble to log down or you have backup tools, that's fine too. So what happens is for the Hadoop cluster we have, we only have about 35 nodes right now. So the way we're distributing, allocating a node is each user will get one node, which means we can support maximum 35 users anyway. So you might need to team up with your neighbors and for the exercise for there. So if you have troubles or you do not have the tools installed, that's fine. As long as your neighbors has them done, that should be good, right? So because we may not be able to support anyone anyway. So if you are able to log on to the runners, so next one is a little bit longer command you need to type in. It starts with the sbatch, then that's the repo. By the way, I already posted the slides on the shared folder we showed yesterday. So if you want to go and download the slides, you may be able to do copy paste of the command line. Okay. So I think the shared folder is posted on the class website under the materials. So if you succeed the second step, and what you should see is you successfully submitted a job and with some numbers, that's going to be your job IDs. Okay, so now I will give you like 5 minutes for the list and to see how many you can actually get to the last steps.
So Wrangler only has a limited number of nodes. I'm not sure if you heard Weijia say that. So Wrangler only has a limited number of nodes available for training purposes. So if you hit that node limit, then some people may not be able to log in. So if your neighbor was able to log in, then you may have to pair up with them to go through the exercises.
Yeah, so the reservation, the number should be 2552, is consistent with the one in the screenshots. I think the one I had there is from the previous one. So if you're doing the step two, this is a break up into two lines, but there should be one line, and there should be a space after two to the next one here. So there are. Okay, so how many of you have already succeeded both step one step and step two? We should. Okay, that's great. So how many of you are still working on it? Okay, so let's give 2 more minutes, then we can continue. And also, if you are having problem, it's okay. You cannot get down right now because we cannot be able to have everybody get down.
If you finish the step one, step two, just leave them there. So we will come back to that. Okay.
Yeah, it seems like most of you already got it. So let's move on to the next one. So first of all, congratulations. That's your first HPC job. You have just submitted, right? On a real cluster. Okay. So what you have accomplished is, so this is what you should see after submitting the job. And what you have done is the SPAC is a command for the job schedulers. So all the HPC system, all the HPC clusters, we will have some type of the job scheduler systems. It's similar as the Yarn in the Hadoop clusters. In type, we use the thing called Slurm, and the SPAC is the one for the Slurm. And some other centers we use a different one. So what you are doing here is basically sending a request. So when you log on, you see the node you are calling is logging one. So you are on the logon node of the routers, and then you tell the job schedulers, I want to do something. I want to run something in the computer. So the second part, the longer part, is Hadoop reservations. It doesn't need to be there. It's more specifically for our purpose here, because we only have part of nodes running the Hadoop clusters. So we need to tell the scheduler we want to have the nodes from the Hadoop reservation rather than from other nodes not in the Hadoop reservations. So that's what the reservation part of it is. So the third part of it is what we call the job script. So in that job script, has details about how you're going to run it and what you're going to run it, and including something like which allocation, which project, and those type of things. So for today's purpose, for your purpose, you don't really need to understand what's in there, but if you're just out of curiosities, you want to see what it does, it's a text file, so you can actually see that text file using TAG or any other text viewers to view them, okay? And also the other thing is after you submitting the jobs, and you will be assigned a job ID, and that job ID to just, it's like you go to the bank and you may take number, so that's a number for your job request, right? So you'll be wondering what after that is, the job will start a job Zapping sessions using one nodes inside the Hadoop clusters. Zapping is a web application, so we need to start it on the computer node, then making the port into a login node, then we can open web browsers and trying to get access to it. You can check on your job status by running the SQ command. So if you have sent the request to there, and if you have succeeded the first two steps, the other thing you can do is you can either do sq-u with your username here, like your train and what kind of number you have, or with sq-j here with your job IDs that output after submitting the job. You should see only one line of your job running. And out of here, the first one is job ID, and the partition refer to which section of the clusters you are trying to run. The most important things you want to look at them is in the ST, stand for status. So that is your current job request status. Typically, you will see two flags. One is R, means your job is already running in the background, right? And the other one you may see is a PD, so that's pending for the pending or still in the waiting stage. You may get in that either because we do not have enough resources to allocate enough nodes for your job at this moment, or there may be something going wrong with it. And the last one is if you have them running, you may see how many times it has run and how many nodes has been actually allocated to you. So this is generic workflow, how you can run an HPC or you can work with the clusters. First, you log on to the login node, and then you submit your job request into the compute node. Then it goes to a job schedulers, and once it has enough resources, it will have your job running. As I mentioned in the beginning, and we only have about 35 nodes useful for the Hadoop clusters, so we may only be able to have 35 people actually get the running status later on. Some of them, if you get the pendings, that may be because we already use all the Hadoop nodes in Hadoop cluster at this moment. If for some reasons you see multiple lines of your jobs are being submitted, sometimes you may accidentally submit them twice, you can cancel one of the jobs so you can release some of the resources. Similarly, if you are done, you do not want to work on it anymore, you can type in the S cancel, followed by your job ID, and you tell the job scheduler, I do not work on this job, I do not use this node anymore, you can recycle it. Okay? So, any questions so far? Anyone still have any problems? Or? Okay.
For the pending job
state,
it's usually
because your job request go to a queue, and then the job scheduler will see if there's enough computer resources to run your job. If all the node has been allocated out, it might put into a pending state here. So basically, it's saying your job is in waiting. So I can also see here. Yeah, I do see a number of them are pending because we might already use most of the Hadoop clusters node already. So if your job is pending and then if your neighbors is not, then you may just view their screens and pull up. So once we done this task, we will have the allocation valid for your current wait. So you still have chance to try it some other times with it. Okay, so if your job is running, the other thing you can do is on the login node, you can do cat, just like cat, and then the zapin.out in that files. So that's a kind of log output file of the zapin of this particular job request we put in. So if you display some information, if your job running, so at the end you may see something like the application UI is at HTTP. Regular.app.us has some numbers, some four numbers. You need to go to open your browsers and in the incognito mode, and then paste this URL in it, and go to that web address. Okay. You try that now if you have job running. If you put the URL into the browsers, and if you go there, it says cannot connect, just leave them there. Make sure you do not make mistakes in the URL. Sometimes if not, when your job has been, it may take a couple of minutes or to several minutes for it to setting up everything correctly before you see it. So if you are lucky and your job was getting in there quicker, if you put in the URL, what you should see is a page like this. So is there anyone already see this page in their browser windows? Okay, great. Great. So if you see this browser windows, you notice on the top right, there's a login button. Just click that button. It should pop up a user and password again. Just using your credential, the train something again there, and then you can log into it. Okay? So if you already see this page, you log in, and you see a basic a simple welcome screen. And up here is a number of notebook currently has. You should only have one if that's the first time you log on to it. And you can, it's called the Zapping Tutorials. There's several interesting things we just to show the basic features. So the first one is the basic features of Spark. It's some functions is being written in there. And then they have a next one for the Python and the PySpark, and then one for the R. So you can click into there and you can open up the notebook. It will look like something like this. If this is the first time you are open a notebook, you may also see it's something like this, have the settings, have interpreter plugins. If this is the first time you open the notebook, you can just simply click save, then that's, you're done with it. So that one shouldn't pop up again, and then you can, later you can easily change that setting as well. So basically what this setting does is to say how many interpreters the current you want the current setting connecting to it. So it does support Spark, Markdown, the AngularJS, the basic shell, and many of other interpreters as well. Okay. If you get the job running and you get the right numbers and you go there, it doesn't show up yet, it's fine, you just wait a few more minutes. But if you think it's more than 10 minutes, it doesn't come up, then we can check again. But usually it may take several minutes after it starts and going to pop up. And, I see like several of you already got it running, that's fine. If you are still in the running or pending or you find the page that doesn't show up yet, it's okay, just keep them there. I can continue with my slides. All the things I want to say is in the slide anyway. If you already have the Zapping working and from the Zapping page, homepage, where you see this, you can just simply create a new note. And it will just ask your name, you can type anything there, you can just say the text one, something like that, and then you go to the interface like that. From here, the by default, it will be a skyline interpreters, and if you do a person page with the Python, it will become the Python interpreters, you can put in the Python line there. It can also do the shell, like just the file systems, so if you put SH in there, it's a basic as a shell. So the other thing you can do is, yesterday when I talked about Hadoop clusters and you can log on, there's a number of the Hadoop file shell command you can try and you can use. You can do that here as well. So for example, you can do Hadoop fs-ls slash, and then here is a small the run button. Oh, wait, you don't see it. Sorry. Someone should call me early. Yeah, so you can create a new node from the homepage here. Just click the new nodes, just any name is fine. And you're getting something like this. So this is more similar to the Jupyter interface as well. You can, here the default is a Scala interpreters. You can change it to Python or change it to Markdown or R or even a shell. What I was doing is to change it to a shell command. So we can run things we did, the exercise I had yesterday, so you can find a few of the Hadoop file shell command here, like list your home directories or list. So you put the command here and then you can run the, if you start and you, this is like the same thing as you run them on the shell. So basically if you have yesterday's slide, then you can go to the exercise. All those commands I'm putting in there, you can run them through this way as well. Okay. You can just do another one. If you get rid of this, it will become a standard interpreters. So anything in my result slide you want to try, you can come here to copy paste or text it in and give it a try. Okay? So now, if you have it working, feel free to play with it. If you do not have it working, just leave them there. So either you are reading for the resources or just give it more time. Let me go back to the slides here. So that's the import nodes I will talk about later. We can skip that one. So that test I was just showing you. So the next several slides, so hopefully I can quickly go through them. What I want to do is give you a quick tour of the Scala programming language. So the Scala, a bit of background is actually same as the Java. So how many of you are using Java? Anyone? Okay. So you might feel it's a little bit familiar. Itself is a JVM base. It has a more abstraction. So all the things you can do with Java, you can do it with Scala. So all the libraries, all the APIs are the same. So you can import a Java library, Java class, very easily. But it turns Java into a more or less a functional programming language. So it's enabling scripting and the interactive usage. It has been used more and more in many of the open source projects just because the language itself is very straightforward in a way. So I won't be able to do a full-fledged tutorials on Scala here. So what I want to do is a quick tour of the Scala just to highlighting several things that's special with the Scala that are different from Java or Python. So whenever I teach a programming language, I would like to break into three parts to see how they are, what their features they have. So it's a variable, function, and how the control flow being defined. So first of all, on the variables part. So variable means integers, doubles, and those type of things, right? So we define variable here. So the number one thing I want to mention with the Scala is the Scala has two larger types of variables. Mutable and immutable variables, right? So you can define, you have to specify, we will define a variable, whether you want to make it mutable or immutable. Does that sound familiar? Immutable, right? So it's that thing we just mentioned with the Spark, right? So all the RDE require it to be immutable and for it to work, right? So that's why Scala is one of the native programming language because using here, it forced the programming language also force you to define declare your variable to be mutable or immutable, right? Okay, so all the thing you see on this on the slides here, is actual code you can type in. Try if you have the engine working and open, you have the interpreter working, and you can type in those. So basically what I'm showing here is what happens with the value when you are trying to assign a assign value to it. So for example, if we do the same thing here, we can define while a equals 6, then we run these lines. It will tell you to define a as an integer as a 6. But since we define as a while, which means it's immutable, and if we want to reassign the a into some values, we will get an error. It tells you reassignment for the immutable variables, right? Okay. So that's what the immutable means. Once you define it, a will should be always equal to 6. Okay. So here, what if we really don't need A anymore? We really need A became 5, right? So if you really don't need A, you can actually define them again, say just while A again, and you run it, the system will treat it as a new variable you are defined. So it will automatically delete the previous one you defined and define a new one here if you add that derivation. So if you have the Debian notebook working, feel free to follow along and try the things we have in the slides. If you don't have them, let's get back to the slides here and to show some basic features of the language. So for the immutable, you cannot change the values. If you really need both, you really need some value that can be changeable, so you want to make a counter, so it can incrementally count one, that sort of things. You can make a var. Var is a variable that can be changed, so that's like a normal variable here. So the mutable and immutable are two keywords you have to give when you define variable in the Scala. So all the variables in the Scala has either mutable or it's one of the tools, okay? Okay, so other than that, the rest of them seems very similar and very common to all the programming language. Say the primitive type, the variables, it has a double float and all those things. And also for the Scala, it's a kind of the dynamic typings. It's defined the types based on, it's not really dynamic, it's a dynamic infer the types. So you do not have to define the variable type to the integers. So in the previous examples, you see when I do the provide 8 to 6, it's automatically assigned an integer type to A, so that you do not have to manually define A. But you can also force it in a certain type, say if you want to do a double type of A, you want to put a integer value, so you can just do something like this, and then it will become a double value in there. If you don't give any declarations, it will assume the smallest numbers, the smallest type for your values. Okay? But it doesn't dynamic change, you have to cast it into a different one. So that's a difference in Python. In Python, later if you want to do it as a double, if from integer as double, it will automatically change that. But in Scala, it doesn't do that. Okay, so that's one difference. And the other thing, the other type of variables is in addition to those singular variables, we have the composite type of variables. So those are the data structures, like the list, the map, sequence, set, tuples. Those type of things are composite type, decomposed by multiple values here. So one of the most commonly used ones in the Scala is the list. And the list, you may see that concept in all the programming language. Java has them, Python has them, all the programming language has them. What's special here with the Scala is the list itself is immutable. So in Scala, if you define a list, the list is something like RDD, it's became immutable, only it's not really automatically partitionable yet. Okay. But list itself is immutable. What we mean by that is once you define a list as this, you can get a elements of that list through the indexing, say the list. You do the parentheses 1, it will return the second one, so it starts with 0, 0, 1, 2 here, so it will return 2 here. But if you want to reassign a value to that position, it will cause you the errors. Okay? So the older values within your list is cannot be changed once you define them. So here, what we say about the immutability of the list is really about the content of the list that is not changeable there. And so you can define the list as the variables using a different using the either mutable or immutable things. So the other thing is when we define normal variables and we do not give a type to that variables, so they can automatically assign whether it's integer or doubles. Similarly for the list itself is not a type. You can further define what's the type of list that it has. Again, if you do not specify it, if you just run this, you can try it in the testing. You just do it and you will automatically get this list being assigned as an integer value, so this means it's an integer list. You can also specify what type it is through this format. You can change it to double or float, so the system will treat it as a double or float type. When you first initialize a list, you can have a means of data type in there. So if, so this is a wide syntax here. So if I do this, what the type of the list should be? Double, right? So because it's trying to accommodate in the most requirements of the it found neutral items there. Okay. So that is you can try that. So if you have running all the programming language questions you want to ask, you can first try it yourself. You will understand it much better than I just told you, but you can or you cannot. So the simple answer is that you cannot append to an existing list. Whatever you do will create a new list. Okay. But if you have a question, you really got to try it, you can. So the list, it sounds like very similar for many of the list structure, for the list, same list structure you found in Java and Python, but in Scala, it has its own features there. So it has a lot of the things that functions are only associated with list, and you won't be able to easily find them out there. So that also makes the list is a perfect base type for a RDD in the Spark as well. Right, so basically, the list data type is made to create an object such as RDD. Okay, so also the list gives a number of ways to iterate throughout them. So in a normal programming language, let's say a simple question like we want to iterate the list and multiply each element by two. So how will you do it? You can do a while do, right? So you can say, create a list. So this is a mutual form of the list. You can call the list a buffer. So you can use them as a regular list to do. If you're coming from Java, it's more extreme buffer type of the type of data types. And in this case, this is probably most traditional ways how you want to do it. You define a variable that can hold the results. And then you iterate through your existing list, do the computation multiply by two, put the result into the placeholder you already created here, the R, and then you put in the data in there. So that sounds nothing wrong with it, right? So that's one of the most traditional. In many of the programming language, you probably do that this way here. Okay. So, but those type of things is rarely happening with the Scala because. Scala doesn't really encourage this type of the usage of the variables and the typings. So while ways is more in addition to while is a for loop. So in this case, this is more like the Scala ways, and it's you have the list to start with, a simple list with three elements, 1, 2, 3, and then you can generate a new list of the result to say for each element in this list. So this operator is basically like in the Python for x in this L, that type of the operator, like the in operator there. It's just like right kind of arrows. When you're generating the result as the elements multiplied by two. So in Python, you can easily convert or run this in Python with converting the operator here into x have a proper definition of the list here. So that's sound reasonable with a Python type of programming, right? So with Scala, the list also comes with the map functions as well. So for the map functions, it's basically you can further simplify a for loop. I say for this list, I want to call a map function. What the function does is for the input, if you transform them into two types of that input. So all three of them will give you the exactly same result out later. But you see, Scala, one thing Scala do is to give the higher level instructions. It has more friendly and more easy for you to pass function as a parameters along. Right? So in this case, even in the for loop, and we define our function here, and we have the result back, the result being automatically stored as a new list. But here is really the program reads like I want to pull this function times two functions, apply them into each single of the elements in my list. So this is this seems all the same, but it's reflects an important concept with the big data processing of the mind concept, and that was allowed in the Spark as well. Any questions so far with the loop structures? All three are runnables in the scalars. You can try all three of them. They give the same result, and the amount of the character you type is definitely different, and but they give the same type of instruction. Yes, sir. Okay, so the other thing you can see here is in the scalars, there's to accomplish the same thing, there's really a number of ways you can do it. So some of the scalar program can be really concise, maybe just one or two lines, but they actually can be converted into 20 or 30 lines. Okay, so it's a tongue talk, so let's take a break, so I will pick up from here.
Can you tell them how to log out, so that way
you
don't need to log out? Okay, just close it out.
Yeah, so if you have Zephyr notebook working on the browsers, and that URL is always be there, so even if you close it, you can always go back to that, as long as your job is running in the background. You can go back to exactly the same sessions you had. We gave you the job script, the default is running for 8 hours, so it should last the whole day here. So you basically not need to worry about the something about the question. But if you do not have the working, so you want to save the working character.